beautiful people, and welcome back to another episode of That's How We Roll, a podcast where I talk with motivating and inspiring women who are professionals, entrepreneurs, organization leaders, artists, and so much more. Today's guest is Lauren Patz, head distiller at Redwood Empire Whiskey. Lauren grew up in a winemaking family and developed an appreciation for food and drink. Lauren has judged at the American Distilling Institute and taught distillation seminars and workshops in the local community. So let's find out her journey to creating a successful whiskey brand and welcome Lauren Patz. Hi, Lauren. Thank you so much for being here.
Hello, Avis. Thank you for having me. Excited to have a chat with you today.
Oh, good. Me too. I'm glad because we've been trying to plan this for a while, and my schedule and your schedule, I know that you are super busy making sure that the best stuff comes out of those barrels, right?
I feel like in this day and age, it's just everybody so busy, got stuff going on, but I'm glad we finally were able to make some time for each other and to chat a little bit about whiskey making and also what it's like to be a woman in distillation.
Yeah, I was so fascinated and delighted to learn that you are a distiller. You know, upon our first conversation, I was like, wait, what? You are? So I said, oh, I have to talk to her more.
I mean, it's a pretty fun job to have. You get to explore a variety of different areas, from chemistry to mechanics to, you know, elements of math. I can't say that I'm a mathematician by any stretch of the imagination, but I do enjoy that element to this role for certain. But of course, anytime you're making a consumable, specifically a luxury one, you have to be able to enjoy being around other people. And it really is about a sense of community. Certainly within the spirits industry. I mean, going bars are a very social thing. And so I would hope that you would enjoy an element of that as well when you get into this job.
Yeah, well, I think that you have that down pat. So you grew up in a winemaking household. Did you know at that time that you wanted to be or that you wanted to remain in the wine and spirits industry because of that?
I definitely didn't. I have to say, like, I think that was really formative for me. Absolutely. My parents started a wine brand when I was very young, and it was a huge part of our life. I like to kind of jokingly say that the winery was my third sibling and by far the most successful. But it really felt like the wine brand and the winery itself was a part of our family when I was growing up. I mean, we would get up and take brick samples, which are sugar samples of grapes in the morning before school to see if they were ready to harvest and then make into wine. Packaging, you know, they ran it out of our family home. So it was a big part of my life. And I have to attribute a lot of my own appreciation for good food and wine to my parents and to what they achieved with their brand. But originally, I thought I was going to be a professor. I thought I was going to be a classics professor. So even in high school, I kind of knew that's the direction I was going to, or thought that was the direction that I was going to go. So when I got into college, I pretty much exclusively took classes on classical medieval studies and Japanese. So there was a potential for some comparative literature, you know, all that good stuff. But then I realized that I didn't want to necessarily do that. And I lived in Japan for a little while, came back to the United States thinking I was going to open a confectionery, which is like a chocolate company. And, you know, through a very convoluted path after that, found my way onto a distillery floor and felt like I really found my place and sense of purpose. And from that, I've really had the opportunity to grow myself professionally and to really build a career.
That's great. At least while you're sitting around either having wine or whiskey, you have something to talk about while you're sipping, right?
That's right. I mean, I could talk to you at length about the Japanese masculinity of the failed hero in ancient Heian Jedi, but I don't know if everybody's up for a conversation like that, but I think it kind of rounds you out. Everyone comes from a different place and has a different perspective, and so it's nice to have something different to contribute to conversations and just worldview in general.
That's true. So what sparked you and led you to continue? Well, you kind of covered that. To continue and pursue and just rise up in the ranks to become a distiller. After school, you decided, okay, I do want to do this. So how did you do it?
Well, I would say I kind of discovered, I guess I would say, spirits, since I had already had a very, you know, fair familiarity with wine, but really started appreciating spirits when I was working at a chocolate factory. I had come back, I mentioned I was interested in maybe opening a confectionery. And during that time, I actually worked for a chocolate factory called Cho Chocolate. And while I was there, I was tasked with doing presentations, tastings of chocolate and other things. So cheese, beer, wine, and of course, spirits. And that's really when I started doing my due diligence into what tasting spirits is, as opposed to just drinking them. And there's a vast difference between drinking spirits and tasting them. And I really discovered what the depth of that, you know, flavor could be with spirits, as opposed to what I would assume many people's first experiences, which is burning.
Right.
And just the heat of it. But if you kind of take a minute to explore what tasting really is, which is, you know, holding that spirit on your palate, specifically with whiskey, that initial heat melts away and you really get an opportunity to taste what that whiskey has to offer. So I did my research, I did a lot more tasting and became very fascinated with what spirits had going on. And I found a distillery that was looking for a tasting room manager and decided to apply. I eventually got that job, and it's very small. There was four of us at the start of that distillery. It was Spirit Works Distillery. And very quickly, I made my way onto the distillery floor and, you know, pretty much became the production manager, the distiller, and then the head distiller there over a fairly short period of time. And I love learning. So I was really excited to kind of explore a realm of which I hadn't touched very often. So as a double humanities major, I didn't have a huge opportunity to explore science or kind of like hands-on mechanical things. And I found that incredibly empowering to be able to take things apart, put them back together, get them to work again, and understand science on a very practical, usable level. I felt a very different connection to that discipline. And it kind of fed my overall passion for distillation. So for me, while I enjoy the social aspect of it and I enjoy tasting spirits, I'm not a huge drinker. And I think that the thing that has really tied me to this as a career and really given me some longevity is the opportunity to kind of continuously learn and develop and gain new skill sets and really push myself and challenge myself. So I think that's really been my biggest motivator over this time, has been to become more and more a master of my craft.
You know, you mentioned about tasting. When you go to a tasting at any of the events, there's no way that you can drink everything that is put out in front of you. You can taste it and then you can spit it out. People think that you would have to be drinking constantly, but you can't drink all the stuff. You can't mix all the alcohols and everything that is going around that they are serving throughout. You are there to taste and to really see if this is a brand that you want to have at your bar or serve at your restaurant. So it's just really, really funny to hear you say that.
Yeah, I mean, in this industry, we just have an incredible amount of access to alcohol. So I have found the easiest way for me to, you know, continue is to exercise a bit of restraint with that in particular. But there's a time and a place for everything. I mean, there's a time and a place for drinking, and there's a time and a place for tasting. And it kind of boils down to like what your goal is. Is your goal to get like buzzed and have a good time? Then drinking, full stop, go for it. But if you're planning to kind of enrich your palate and really kind of explore a little bit more about a specific spirit or specific brand, it really behooves you to take the time to sit with it and be a little bit more thoughtful about what you're consuming.
And think about what you're tasting or what you're smelling. So you mentioned earlier about being a woman distiller. This is not an industry that a lot of women are head of or really involved with or in the way that men are. Are men surprised or taken aback in situations where you show up as the distiller, the person that knows about the product? What is their reaction? Are they looking behind you for the man? Like, who is this Lauren Patz from Redwood Whiskey?
Yeah, is she a brand ambassador? You know, is she, you know, a shot girl? No, just kidding. You know, it's interesting. It's not just men who are surprised. It's certainly women as well are they don't automatically connect my gender with what my role is. I think for most people, the visual that comes to mind when you think of a distiller is still a man, you know, is a white man with a beard and flannel and potentially overalls. I mean, that's just kind of some of the things that when you say the word distiller, that's I think often what the imagery kind of provokes. And so it is always a bit of a surprise. I have to say I've always been very embraced by this community and I've never felt like out of place. Part of that is just due to the fact that, you know, my personality, I oftentimes don't ever feel out of place. I'm just kind of like, oh yeah, I deserve to be here, you know. I feel comfortable. So part of it is that, but also I really haven't experienced much in the way of overt negativity to my presence. That being said, there is absolutely overwhelming surprise, whether it be positive or negative, in my role and my presence within the company. Internally, I feel like the companies that I've worked for have been really great about just allowing me to have a voice and to be heard. And if there's one message I could really reiterate and I feel is so important for, you know, other women and other minorities to hear is like, absolutely, there is a place for you here. And I think people want you to be present and to see what your vision is for spirits, for cocktails, for every tier of this industry, sales, distribution, and production. So I think there's real opportunity here, but there's still a long way to go before that image of what a distiller is changed into something a little bit more universal or vague, I guess.
We are fortunate that we have someone like you that uses your voice, and that's good. That is something that other women, young girls, can learn from and see that the type of role model that you are. Use your voice, have your ideas. Don't be afraid to voice your opinion or to intervene and to throw out ideas.
Definitely. Yeah, I strongly feel that way. And, you know, that you deserve to be heard. You know, sometimes people don't necessarily want to hear your point of view, but, you know, I think that there's value in hearing everybody out. So, yeah, in my very start of my career, it was a question that got asked a lot. And I always really shied away from it because, you know, I had this feeling like, why should it matter? You know, what does it matter if I'm a woman? I want to be a distiller. Like, you know, it didn't really connect to me. But now I feel like I just want, you know, everybody out there who might not think, you know, of themselves as being a distiller, that absolutely you can be.
Tell us your secret to distilling. I know it's all about flavor and smell, but what is your secret to getting that perfect blend or that perfect taste?
Well, I have three secrets, and they are the three P's. There's patience, palate, and passion. So distillation as a process is a lot of hurry up and wait. You're hurrying to get things up and running, you know, get things to achieve equilibrium on your still and your system. And then you're kind of letting it run its course. You get everything set up, everything's running good, and then you wait for it to finish. And so you have to be very patient there. You have to be very patient during the aging process. Straight whiskey has a minimum of 2 years in barrel. And if you want to take an age statement off of your label, you have to be a minimum of 4 years. So you have to be very patient, because all this hard work that you're doing today, you're not going to see it again for years later. So you have to really be, you know, okay with the fact you might not necessarily see the results of your labor right after you're done completing it. And then, of course, passion. You really have to love this job, because it is a lot of cleaning. It's a lot of paperwork. There's a lot of things about distillation that I would consider not to be glamorous. Although, luckily, this day and age, I think people really have this romanticized version of what a distiller is, you know, with shows like, what is it, Moonshiners and things like that.
Oh,
they have
yeah.
this idea of just kind of out in the woods with a little pot next to you chugging away. Commercial distillation tends not to look like that. There are certainly craft distilleries that do have smaller stills that are a little bit more in that vein, but national brands and people who are doing kind of larger volume distillation, it's a very different beast in how things operate on a day-to-day basis, safety measures and warehousing. It's a lot of internal tracking for the TTB, which is the federal regulatory body for spirits. And so you'd be surprised by how much work there is. I don't want to say busy work, but there's certainly plenty of that if you want to operate smoothly and legally. And I think people often see the fun side of it, the cocktails and all that, which is certainly a part of it. But, you know, real operations is a different matter for sure. So you really have to love it in order to get through some of that stuff.
What is the process for a perfectly flavored whiskey?
Well, it always starts off with your raw materials. So you have to choose what your raw material is going to be. And part of that is decided by what type of whiskey you're going to be making. So if you're going to be making bourbon, then you have to have a 51% minimum of your raw materials being corn, rye, 51% of your raw materials being rye, and so on and so forth. So the first is to choose your raw materials well. We're lucky enough, we get our raw grain from California. The majority of it is coming from California, so it's nice to have it local. We can go out and see the fields if we would like. We have a great grain supplier, Adams Grain, that we have a good relationship with. So very first thing you want to do is get your raw materials squared away, understand what your mash bill will be, which is what you're going to be using. So it's the percentage breakdown of your grain. So mash bill will be either that 51% or whatever of the grain that you're going to be using. So for us, our typical bourbon mash bill is at about 70% corn, about 18% rye, and then the rest is broken down between malted barley and wheat. And so it's a 4-grain bourbon. And that's our kind of like typical mash bill. We do a variety of different others. Next year, we're going to start doing a slightly higher wheat bourbon, since wheat is my favorite grain to be working with. But that's your first decision, is the grain composition of your mash bill, and then also your raw material selection. So where are you going to be sourcing those from? The second is your mash-in process. So that's the process of readying the grain for fermentation, for the yeast to do conversion of sugar into ethanol. And you do that by breaking down starch. So grain is stored sugar, it is in starch. And so we need to break down those starch molecules into much more readily consumable and accessible sugar molecules. And you do that through an enzymatic process called saccharification. So you're adding water, some people add enzymes, which we do, and then also you can add malt, which has those enzymes naturally occurring, and they break down the starch into more simple sugars. And so that takes about a day to kind of heat and cool. You're correcting for pH and a few other things. And once you've gotten to a certain sugar concentration and you know you're going to get valuable ethanol yields off of it, you can go ahead and pitch your yeast And then fermentation can take anywhere from 3 to 7 days. Right now with our tank space, we do about 7-day fermentations, but we're going to cut that down next year in order to increase overall efficiency. So then you got your fermentation going, and that is really just a microbial process of the yeast eating and eating and eating sugar and excreting ethanol. And so for us, we're getting at about 10% ethanol at the end of fermentation. If we get anything under that, we just don't get the efficiencies off of our still that we're looking to yield wise. So after fermentation, we hook it up to our still. We have a continuous column still, which means that we're continuously feeding in product into the system, and we are continuously reaping finished product off of it. So in goes that 10% alcohol fermentation. And when we get the ethanol coming off of the still, it's about 120, 125 proof. So significantly higher than what we started out with. And then it separates heads on its own and tails as well. So we're kind of left with just the good stuff, just the sweet spot, the hearts of the distillation. And then that hearts will be proofed for barrel entry. And that's between 120 and 110 proof. That goes into barrel, and kind of have to cross your fingers and hope that whatever comes out of that barrel after however many years is exactly what you are intending to achieve.
Yeah, you mentioned about cutting a process down. You said it's 7 days. Does that, or maybe it doesn't, does it have an effect on the product? Or is it better to have it shorter? Or is it better to have it a longer period of time within those 7 days?
Mm-hmm. For fermentation. You know, every distiller is going to tell you that their way is the best way. And there is an interesting lack of scientific research done with distillation in particular that is readily available, because most of the larger companies, you know, they employ their own chemical engineers and microbiologists to kind of get all of that information, and they keep it internally. So there really isn't a huge amount of decisions that are being made made by distillers backed up by scientific research. So it gives you a lot of leeway as a distiller to explain, you know, give your hypothesis mm-hmm. as to why your way is the best way, which is why I love listening to distillers speak, because their point of view is always so fascinating to me about what their argument is for process decisions. But there's always going to be things that change if you make process changes. So changing your fermentation from 7 to 5 days will absolutely have an impact on your overall final product. You know, it's hard to try and figure out exactly what that might be. You know, what part of what's happening during fermentation is a process called esterification, which is the bonding of alcohol and acids. And it is one of the things that contributes largely to aromatics on whiskey. So there is the potential for those changing, and also just the percentage of how much of that is happening to change as well. But I've done a lot of different, I've done fermentations in 3 days, you know, I've done fermentations in 3 weeks, and I feel very confident that we are going to be achieving the same quality product that we are now by shortening it by just a few days.
And how long is the entire, you're putting them in barrels, so you've done this process, now they're in the barrels, and how long is the entire process from start to finish, from the time that you complete this fermentation process in the barrels, and then before you open the barrels and bottle it?
I mean, that's totally dependent on your decisions as a distiller. It depends on what you want to call it and what you want to make. I mentioned before, if you want to make a straight whiskey, it's a minimum of 2 years in barrel. If you want to take your age statement off of your bottle, off your label, it has to be a minimum of 4 years, but you don't have to put it in there for any specific period of time to make quote unquote whiskey.
I have no idea what the answer is, but the difference between bourbon and whiskey, what is it?
Oh, that was the question. Yeah. Okay. Whiskey is an umbrella term. So whiskey, it is bourbon, it's rye, it's blended, it's, you know, it's everything. Whiskey is is a much broader term for spirits that are distilled from grain. There are a couple of added restrictions that make it whiskey in terms of like how much rectification is happening during distillation. But for the main definer, it is spirits coming from grain. And bourbon is a type of whiskey. So it's a more specific definition of whiskey. And it is a very, and by that, I mean, it's like bourbon has to be, you know, 51% corn. It has to be, you know, put into these very specific barrels, like all of that stuff is part of what makes bourbon bourbon. But bourbon is whiskey.
Okay, because sometimes I always get confused and thinking is something different.
Yeah, you're not alone. Trust me. There are plenty of people who have asked that question before. And so it's always good to make sure that it gets, you know, clarified, because it's a big one. If I could, I would highly recommend, if people are interested in spirits, I highly recommend reading the TTB Standards of Identity. It has a very specific explanation for every single type of spirit. And those are the legally binding definitions that we have to adhere to as producers. It's not even that long.
Okay.
So don't be intimidated.
Okay, good. You taught seminars and workshops on distilling. Did you have a lot of women in these seminars or workshops, or were they mostly attended by men? And did you find that more women now are interested in getting into the wine and spirits industry? I know it's kind of a twofold question.
Yeah, well, so I used to teach, I haven't taught a straight class in a couple of years, like since pre-pandemic, but I like to think that any sort of conversation I have, any, you know, interview that I do or any event that I am attending or hosting is an opportunity for education, because it's something that's really important to me. But I haven't done an official distillation class since before the pandemic. So it's been a couple of years. But during those times, absolutely almost all men. But that did start to change a little bit. There were, I'd say maybe in a group of 20, there were one or two women in classes. One of the things is that I was at a distilling conference the very first year. So this was probably about a decade ago. I went to a distilling conference, and there was almost no minorities, no, you know, women, no people of color, nothing. And it was kind of surprising. And then I recently attended one maybe just a year or so ago, 2 years ago, and far more representation by far. It was a huge difference in a fairly short period of time how much it has grown. So, you know, I felt really pleased to see that. I think there are lots of women who are interested in getting into spirits and distillation, particularly on the production side. And I'm so excited to see that.
Yeah.
And to see that they feel the confidence and the interest and the passion to be involved. And it's really, really cool to see. Like I said, I've always been very well received and embraced by my community, the spirits community. And so I think it's very welcoming. And I've seen how much growth there has been with diversity within our community. Absolutely.
Now, I love hearing that. That's really good to hear, to know that the industry and people are really broadening their expertise and their experience to be in any industry they want to be in.
Absolutely.
Redwood debuted at Bar Convent Brooklyn. And Bar Convent Brooklyn is a space where vendors, sellers, and mixologists gather to celebrate, educate, and generate business opportunities in this beverage space. And you were there in June of 2022 in the Emerging Brand section. Did Redwood win any awards? I know that there was an award ceremony surrounding the Emerging Brands, which was quite big, actually. I know that there were celebrations and awards given. Did Redwood carry home any awards?
So Chilled Magazine was putting on I think it was their inaugural awards ceremony. And we did win a few things. One was a packaging award, and one was, it's like an environmental award, and with our work with redwood trees. For every bottle that is sold, we plant trees through a program called Trees for the Future. And so that's part of our internal vision as a company, is to give back a little bit, since we are, you know, branded as the Redwood Empire, which is a very small geographic location, kind of coming from San Francisco Bay up to the Oregon border, the only area in the world that has coastal redwoods on it. So, you know, we want to give back something to the environment. So that's kind of what we've decided to do.
That's great. You have to make sure that I have that information so that I can include it in the show notes so people can check out. Some people just want to know about it so they can just take part in it and buy just because of the message behind it.
Totally.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
I'm finding that so many women in this industry, in this space, that are co-founders, owners, and like you, are distillers. Were there women distillers that you knew or that were your role models when you were learning and growing as a baby distiller?
As a baby distiller? I'd say most of my mentors were men. So unfortunately, I didn't have contact with women who were distillers. You know, it was still relatively getting started up as an industry. And so I unfortunately didn't get to have many conversations with women who were distillers. There were absolutely women who were distilling at that time, but Leslie Gracie from Hendrix. I mean, I always think of Hendrix as being like the gateway gin. It kind of was the resurgence of gin and made gin accessible and cool again. Mm-hmm. So I always had a lot of respect for her. But really, I'd say I certainly know more female distillers now than I did when I was starting out. So most of my mentors, most of the people I learned from were from men.
And the good thing about that is that, which I like, that you said that they were men and at least they were encouraging because they did not discourage you. They wanted to teach. And that's always good. They just saw you as someone that wanted to learn to do something.
Right. Yeah. Definitely.
Tell us where people can buy Redwood.
We are distributed nationally. We are part of a company called Purple Brand, which is really known for winemaking. So we have Rayburn Chardonnay and a few other wine brands. And that's really where the capital came from to build out the distillery. So we have a really great connection with our distributors nationally. And when we started producing whiskey and putting whiskey out into the market, was immediately nationally distributed. But it should be fairly readily available. I'm sure that our website is a good resource for that.
Excellent. Well, just before we close out, I just wanted to ask if you have any advice that you can offer to other women wanting a career in the spirits industry and words of wisdom that you can offer to them or to anyone.
Yeah, I think that any words I would offer are probably a little bit more general than specifically targeted for distillation. But anytime that you're hungry to grow in your career, I would say make yourself invaluable. Make yourself the person to go to when there's a problem, when there's a question. One of the things that I did early on when I started off on the floor was I was obsessively cleaning and organizing and putting things away. And part of what that allowed for was anytime someone was looking for something, they would come and ask me where it was, and I always knew where it was. Yeah. I think that happens enough time, people start to be like, oh, she really knows what she's talking about. Like, she's valuable here. And to really feel confident in expressing yourself and in your point of view, you know, feel free, absolutely ask questions and, you know, leave some room for change and development in your thought process and your beliefs, but also say your piece.
Yes.
Yeah.
Say your piece. Oh, should we do a tasting?
Oh, yes. Yeah, let's go ahead and do a tasting. I like to taste them in order of our bourbon, our rye, and then our blended whiskey. So that's the Pipe Dream, the Emerald Giant, and then the Lost Monarch.
So Pipe Dream, Emerald Giant, and Lost Monarch. Okay. So I'm doing the Redwood, the Pipe Dream first.
Mm-hmm. So this is our bourbon. It is a blend of 4 to 14-year-old whiskey coming from 4 different states and 4 different grains. So there's a lot going on with this whiskey. I think that there's a lot of depth and complexity. As a spirit category, bourbon tends to be fairly soft, fairly sweet. It has a tighter range of expectations from consumers. So it has often a lot less experimentation with bourbon. You know, people know what they want from that category, and most of the time suppliers try to give it to them. We've done a little bit with layering flavor, specifically with the wheat component. I love working with wheat. I think it adds kind of a nice floral fruit component, oftentimes like apricot, that gives some dimension to the spirit as a whole. But for me, a bourbon is successful if it has a certain level of viscosity to it. So really some weight on the palate. You don't want it to instantly evaporate as it hits your tongue.
Okay, what I smell is like vanilla or caramely or something. It smells a little like caramel.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm going to put it on my tongue. It is sweet.
Bourbon is always considered to be like the gateway whiskey. It is much, much more accessible than some of the other whiskey types out there. And so people really, really gravitate towards it for that.
I kind of like, I'm only putting a little drop in the glass.
Sure. Yeah, so creamy, sweet.
Yes.
All good stuff.
It really is. It's quite nice. If you make mixed drinks with whiskeys, I know you can. Is this a whiskey that is better just on ice?
All spirits should be able to be sipped on their own and should be able to be mixed in cocktails. All spirits should be able to do that. Otherwise, you're missing out on a whole category of consumption.
Right, you are.
Well, one of the best things about spirits is that it invites the consumer to be a participant in their own consumption. Mm-hmm. I mean, with wine and beer, you're given a finished final product. It's kind of put in front of you. You enjoy it and you drink it. But with spirits, you get to be creative. You get to make cocktails. You get to decide at what concentration you're drinking at. You get to be much more involved in what you're doing.
So I just poured the Emerald Giant. Oh, I see it already has a different smell. I don't smell the vanilla.
Mm-mm. This should be much more savory. It should be herbal. People often think sage or caraway, tobacco.
Yes.
But as a spirit category, rye tends to be fairly divisive. People either really like it or really don't like it. In market right now, it's much more popular to make like really spicy, really astringent, aggressive rye. This rye, Emerald Giant, is a much softer, gentler expression of rye. We're really looking to, again, get that accessibility for this category and really make people enjoy and appreciate what makes rye rye, which is, again, kind of the savory approach towards whiskey.
Yeah, that was quite savory. All right, so now I'm going to do the Lost Monarch.
Yeah. Lost Monarch is a blended whiskey, so I like to call it a rye bin. It is 55% rye and 45% bourbon. And it's kind of like a best of both worlds type situation. So you get a lot of those really fun bourbon notes on the nose, the vanilla, the cream, like cream soda almost.
I did. And that's what I got.
Yeah. It's like kind of like root beer-ish, and then you taste it and you get a little bit more of that spiciness. It lifts off the palate a little bit and gives you some of that tingly feeling that you would expect from a rye.
Like coming in from the snow when it's 20 below and you just need a little heat.
Mm-hmm. I wouldn't know anything about snow.
I know,
from
right?
California.
You're like, what is that?
What is that?
Oh my, I like that.
It's a fun one. It's just very versatile as a spirit.
Yeah, it is. Like all three of these are quite nice. Redwood Empire Whiskey. All three are quite nice and just not what I would have expected a whiskey to be. These are smooth, very smooth.
Yeah, we're looking to create that approachability. We want people to drink whiskey, so we want to make it something that's enjoyable.
Well, if you guys come to the East Coast and start having any kind of tastings, like maybe on your next outing here, if you come out here for a big event or a show, you have to do some pop-ups or something in the city and have some cool tastings. I'll be there.
Awesome. Now, I'm glad to have your support.
Well, thank you, Lauren, so much for being here and giving us so much insight on distilling and redwood and just whiskey in general. I appreciate you being here.
Absolutely, my pleasure. I love preaching the good word of whiskey, so...
Well, everyone, make sure that you like, subscribe, and share the podcast. If you have any questions, just please DM me. Find Redwood Whiskey online on Instagram. I will put everything in the show notes. And you can just send me a message, send Lauren a message. We'd be happy to answer them. I'm on Apple, Spotify, and every place. And just follow me, follow Redwood. Thank you so much for tuning in and joining us. And Lauren, I appreciate you being here so much.
Cheers.
Cheers. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen, checking out the podcast. Thank you for inviting me into your space. And until next time, I hope you will continue to thrive, grow, and be kind to yourselves and be kind to others.